Hi, I'm Nick Zeppos, Chancellor of Vanderbilt University. Welcome to the Zeppos Report, a podcast where I talk with the people shaping and helping us understand our world. My distinguished guest today is Alberto Gonzalez, former White House counsel and U.S. Attorney General during the George W. Bush administration. Alberto is a fellow legal scholar that has now found his home in higher education. He currently works right across the street from our university, serving as the dean of the Belmont University College of Law. Alberto has visited Vanderbilt in the past to join a discussion that we hosted about the U.S. Supreme Court vacancy. He is joining me today to provide insights about his career in public service and to share his current work here in Nashville and to illuminate the world in which we are living. Alberto, welcome to the Zeppos Report.
Mr. Chancellor, thank you for having me.
Okay, well, you wrote a really remarkable memoir called True Faith and Allegiance last year. What led you to kind of really open up and tell your story at this point in your career, and how much of it was also learning more about yourself and your place now as an educator?
I wrote the book primarily for my sons. I wanted them to know the reasons their dad did certain things. I wanted them to have a full appreciation of service at various levels of government. I wanted to set the record straight, quite frankly. There's a lot of information out there that's incomplete or inaccurate about some of the things that we did in the Bush administration. So that's another reason that I wrote the book. It was hard. It's a very hard thing to do, to write a book about, particularly about significant and difficult experiences in your life. But it was worthwhile also. It was sort of cathartic to kind of get it out there and say some things that I had always wanted to say for a long time. So I thought it was important, and I've heard from a lot of folks, for President Bush, for example, who felt it's a very important contribution to our history and to the discourse, the discussion. Not that everyone's going to agree with everything that I write or say, but simply having a different voice, I think, is important.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that telling your story, you're a part of a history of our great country. And so you're telling your story frames questions and gives insights and provides perspectives that, you know, people will study the period and say, well, it wasn't that simple.
Oh.
Or there's another side to the story. And so I really commend you for that. Your story is a remarkable story in our country, and certainly for service in our country. Growing up modestly in Humble, Texas, one of eight in a two-bedroom home. Looking back, and as you wrote your book, what were the dreams that you had growing up in that environment?
And I wanted to play center field for the San Francisco Giants because my hero was Willie Mays. And I loved baseball. And in the summer, my brothers and I would play baseball every evening, every morning, and every afternoon. In between, my mom would make us take a nap. But that was my dream. I wanted to be a professional baseball player. And, you know, I came of age at a time when the Colt 45s were first established in Houston. They later became the Houston Astros. And for over half a century, Chancellor, I waited and waited and waited for a championship. And then finally, this year, the Astros finally won the World Series. It was a great day in Houston, and for Houstonians like myself.
Did you ever see Willie Mays play?
I never saw him play live. Of course, I saw him play on television.
Television, so yeah.
Obviously, Hall of Fame player.
I saw him play. I grew up in Milwaukee, in the old Milwaukee Braves.
There you go.
And, you know, it was National League. And, I was very fortunate to see people like Willie Mays and Sandy Koufax and, of course, our own great Henry Aaron and Warren Spahn. Eddie Matthews, number 41. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were – did you get heartburn when they moved the Astros out of the National League? Because so many of us – grow up as National League, American League, and it's just the senior circuit.
It's not right. Let me just put it that way.
I mean, you'll take the World Series.
But it's not right. Come on.
Listen.
It's honestly like moving Texas A&M into the Southeast Conference and not having Texas and Texas A&M play each other every year. It's just not right.
I'll get working on that.
Okay, thank you.
I'll talk to Mike Young about that for sure. Many of the, you interact with students all the time, and certainly many of the listeners are going to be students at your great school and certainly at Vanderbilt as well. When did you get that spark to pursue law? When did that hit you?
You know, when I graduated from high school, no one talked to me about going to college, so I went in the Air Force, and my first duty assignment was Fort Yukon, Alaska, north of the Arctic Circle. This little 19-year-old kid from Houston, and there were two Air Force Academy graduates who were stationed there, and they saw something in me, I suppose, and they said, you should try to go to college and try to get an appointment to the Air Force Academy.
Wow.
And I was able to do that, and my dream was to be a fighter pilot. That's what I wanted.
Okay, well,
at that
you're setting high standards. I'm going to be a center fielder.
A Hall of Fame center fielder.
And then
a fighter pilot.
Yeah,
but my eyes betrayed me. And so I left and I transferred to Rice University in Houston. And the reason that I went to that school was because when I was a boy, 12 and 13, I sold soft drinks at Rice University football games. And that's when Texas A&M was in the Southwest Conference of Texas.
Yeah.
And so when I get to Rice, I immediately major in political science. And honestly, most of the political science majors were all going to go to law school.
Yeah.
I really had not given much thought before then about law school. But as the more I thought about it, the more it made sense for me. It was something that I felt I could really make a difference. And all my friends were going to go to law school. So that's when I first started thinking about becoming a lawyer, was when I was a junior in college at Rice.
Were you able to get the national service bug when you were at the Air Force Academy? How did kind of being around people who serve and put their life in danger when we're sleeping soundly, and did that come across in your time at the Air Force Academy?
It came across actually before then. When I enlisted in the regular Air Force as a serviceman, I quickly realized, what a privilege it was to serve our country. And if, being a poor kid, from a poor family, I felt equal. The military is like in athletics. It's a great equalizer. And so I thought that was important, and that continued through my time at the academy. And then obviously when you go to law school, it is a responsibility, I think. It is part of the price of being a lawyer is serving others in the community. Take your law degree and provide pro bono services and do things that will help others. Yeah, absolutely.
What did law school seem like when you went? Was it a big shock in terms of this is a different type of pedagogy, or, there's a ruthless competitiveness, or I'm really interested in law and legal institutions? What was your reaction when you went off to Harvard Law School?
It was hard, first of all. It's different than going to college, and many graduate programs are that way. It's more competitive. Although I will say that going to Harvard, I think much like going to Vanderbilt, if you do reasonably well, you're going to get a job. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's cutthroat competition. But nonetheless, you've got some very, very motivated, very talented students that you're competing with. And I loved my time in Cambridge. I chose Harvard because it was a different part of the country for me. I knew I wasn't going to practice there. I knew I was going to come back to Texas and practice law. But I enjoyed the experience. I became a Red Sox fan. I became a New England Patriots fan because of that reason. And so it was a great 3 years for me. When I graduated, as I planned from the beginning, I moved back to Texas and began practicing law at a law firm in Houston.
Mm-hmm. And then what brought you back into service?
I practiced law for 13 years, made partner at Vinson Elkins in Houston, was doing great, had a wonderful life. We bought a nice home in a great neighborhood in West University, just doing great. But what I realized is I was a little bit bored. I didn't feel fulfilled. And I wanted to do something different. I got involved in a lot of nonprofit work, serving on boards of directors of various organizations in Houston to try to fill that itch.
Yeah.
But it still wasn't enough, and I knew I wanted to do something different. And so when about a year before the 1994 gubernatorial elections, I met George W. Bush, and I liked him immediately, but I thought he had no chance of beating Ann Richards, the incumbent.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I watched that race very carefully, and when he won, he asked me to come work as his general counsel, I just jumped at the chance because I thought, this is something different, this is something challenging, and I really thought this would be a great opportunity for me and my family.
Yeah. Was the transition to the politics of Washington, D.C. from the politics of Texas and Austin
a big shock? Yeah, it was very different. Governor Bush worked very well with a very powerful Democratic lieutenant governor and a very powerful Democratic speaker. They all worked together for the good of Texas. And the Texans that went up to Washington with Bush, we felt he would be able to replicate that success and be able to work well with Democrats. And it just didn't happen. And from the very get-go, it was difficult. Now, there was a lull in the period immediately after 9/11 when all of America sort of got together and supported the president and what the president was trying to do. But for the most part, much different environment in Washington, D.C. than the one we encountered in Austin.
Yeah, I had a visit from Sally Yates several weeks ago, and she made a comment that was, to me, profound and simple, but the Department of Justice is the only agency really named after a virtue. That's not as functional as education or state. How did you think of the Department of Justice? I mean, many of us think of there's, you know, the criminal enforcement, but there's so much more. How did you think of the justice part of the Department of Justice?
Well, it was a very important part, but it was only one part of it. You know, the Attorney General, unlike any other cabinet secretary, wears two hats. The first hat is, you're a member of the president's cabinet. You're a member of the president's team. He places you in that position. Your job is to promote the president's law enforcement policies and priorities. And there's nothing wrong with that. You go to the Hill and lobby members of Congress for what the president wants. But you also wear the chief law enforcement officer hat, and that is where investigations and prosecutions have to be pursued without regard to who it is, without regard to any kind of bias, without regard to whether or not it's a sibling or, you know, the son or daughter of the president or a friend of the president. So that has to be impartial, and I think it's, for most Americans, they only think about the second hat. They don't think about the first hat, and they sometimes get the two roles confused, and that sometimes makes it difficult for the Attorney General and the Department of Justice.
I think you're right that the election of a president is going to include a set of policy priorities.
Gun policy.
Yeah.
Voting policy.
Yeah.
I mean, all kinds
marijuana
of
marijuana policy.
Absolutely.
All of these things.
And I trust everything.
And so that's going to be part of an executive branch agenda, but yet you had this second hat too.
Very important, but it's a different hat.
How did you interact with the White House where second hat issues arose?
And
you had been the White House counsel.
I'd been the
too,
White House counsel.
So you kind of had that hat too. So.
The advantage of being White House counsel, then moving over to Justice, were these. One, of course, I knew all the White House players, and that's important as a cabinet secretary to know where the power is within the White House.
Yeah.
Two, because I'd been White House counsel, I knew all the major players at the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
I knew them, they knew me. And of course, then I had that relationship with the president, which made me more influential amongst my cabinet peers. And for the Attorney General, that's important because oftentimes it's the Attorney General that says no to the other cabinet secretaries, and the other cabinet secretaries need to know that the president fully supports the Attorney General. But there is, by practice, limitations on the number of contacts and types of contacts between the White House and the Department of Justice on investigations and prosecutions. And typically, it's only the White House counsel speaking with the Deputy Attorney General. That's generally the limitation of the communications between the White House and the Department of Justice on investigations or prosecutions. If you're talking about policy, there are going to be a lot, many more contacts, obviously, but that's how you try to protect the integrity of an investigation and prosecution, is to limit those contacts so that there isn't the appearance of pressure from the White House upon the Department of Justice.
Yeah, and then how would you characterize, since you've left, we've had two sitting presidents, how has that role remained the same, or how has it changed over the years since you stepped aside?
You know, it's hard for me to really assess that without knowing more information about the motivations of the White House, the pressures of the White House, the communications from the White House to the Department of Justice. Sometimes I see the Department of Justice and the Attorney General, Eric Holder, for example, staking out a position on something, and I'll think, man, that sounds strange. That doesn't sound right. And it may reflect Eric Holder's position, but it also may reflect the White House position.
Yeah.
And we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
Particularly in these jobs, you never know what you don't know.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So I always try to give the benefit of the doubt to the decision makers, because you'll never have as much information as the president about an issue. You'll never have as much, general will not have as much information about the cabinet secretary. So I try to be respectful about the decisions that are made. Sometimes I just don't know.
Yeah. How would, if we're going to a new world with social media and Twitter, how does that play out in your role as Attorney General? Because there's so many communications, and of course, we're seeing, you know, a certain level. How would you as Attorney General deal with the sort of things that we now see in social media from all different directions, but particularly from the White House?
Yeah, I think I would make two points about that. You're absolutely right. The technology and the amount of communication that exists today is just far greater than when I began in government service. I remember when Bush became governor, this is in the late 90s, we were just now seeing email, and he did not have an email account as governor because we wanted to protect him from that.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the White House, we tried as hard as we could to limit any kind of email access to the President of the United States. The thing that I think people lose sight of the fact is that any communication involving government business is a government record. No matter what kind of form or what device it's on, if it relates to government business, it is a government record. And you have an obligation as a government employee to preserve it, to protect it, so that at the end of the administration, you turn it over to the National Archives. And so the fact that we have all these kind of different kind of communications, the danger is, of course, people, they forget, oh, this is a government record. People are going to read it.
Yeah.
But there is still that obligation to preserve it and protect it and turn it over when you leave office.
Yeah, one argument that I was always really, I guess, privileged to make in cases involving foreign policy, prosecutorial discretion, as somebody way down the food chain from where you were in the department, was in certain matters, the country speaks with one voice, the unitary executive. And, you know, having been a Justice Department lawyer, that was just something we thought was essential. And of course, Hamilton writes about it, and Madison, you don't want plural executives. Do you concern yourself that so much talk from the executive branch and expressions of the president's feelings are actually undermining this idea of a unitary executive, or are they putting at risk the president's state of mind in a unitary executive model? I know it sounds esoteric, but yet I worry about someone speaks for the country, and that's it, one voice. And when you start saying, well, that really doesn't matter, is there a long-term challenge for the unitary executive?
I think one could make the argument there's less danger today because you do have a president that communicates directly through Twitter. And so that you know exactly what the president of the United States, the head of the executive branch, what his position is on certain issues and policies. I don't think it's ever been the case that only the president has spoken out on on various issues. I mean, he does have this. He does have the cabinet. He has thousands of people that work for him, and there are often communications that do not come directly from the president that nonetheless represent the policies and directives of a certain president.
Yeah.
So I guess to respond to your question, I'm not that worried about it. I would say I do get a little bit concerned that when you have communications that, like we're seeing today, people are not as disciplined about what they say. And I think that can be dangerous because words do have meaning, particularly when they come directly from the President of the United States.
Yeah. Do you think it could imperil prosecutions if a president, not just this president, but another president says, we've got to go after this person?
I think it could. It could, but this is somewhat ironic. I'm not speaking about this president.
No, and it's come up before,
but,
too.
But if you have a president that keeps making these kind of statements, the judge may say, or if you're the prosecutor, you would say, well, you know, this president says things like that all the time, and so it doesn't really matter. I mean, it shouldn't matter in this particular case. But I think you need to be careful because even the appearance of impropriety, even the appearance of the president putting his thumb on the scale, ever so slightly, I think is damaging to the justice system.
Yeah. Well, I certainly, you and I can say things, and the next thing we know, this is what Belmont thinks, or this is what Vanderbilt thinks. I'm like, really?
Well, I mean, probably I would you, just, you more so.
Oh, no. Let's talk about your pivotal role in judicial selection and what you as White House counsel, then as Attorney General, how did you work with the president and the White House in really appointing, finding high quality candidates that maybe reflect more of the changing demographics of the country and then working to get the best people confirmed?
Well, we had different processes for the district court bench and the Court of Appeals than we did for the Supreme Court. So let's just do the first one with respect to district court judges and courts of appeals. We had a White House Judicial Selection Committee that consisted of lawyers within the Department of Justice and lawyers within the White House Counsel. We would identify vacancies around the country. We would consult with a senior Republican in that state. Typically, it would be the home state senator. And then we would identify the best two or three candidates and invite those in for interviews at the White House. And then based upon the interview, the Judicial Selection Committee would agree on one person, and then we would take that name to the president, and he would, as a general matter, accept the recommendation. There were times, and I've talked about this publicly before, where the President Bush would look at the list, and if he felt there was insufficient diversity, he would raise that as an issue. Now, quality and qualifications, judicial philosophy was always of paramount concern and importance. But for President Bush, he felt that there was talent in all segments of our society, and then we should go the extra mile in trying to find that talent. The selection of Supreme Court justices was something quite different. It was a process that began during the transition. We began developing a list of names of potential candidates. And in the beginning, we had over 200 names.
Wow.
And over a period of time, you start whittling them down. Mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons, people would come off the list. And at the end of the day, it fell upon five individuals to make the final recommendation to the president. That would be Vice President Cheney at the time, Andy Card, the Chief of Staff. Now I'm the Attorney General during the second term. It would be myself as the Attorney General, Harriet Myers, the White House Counsel, and Karl Rove as a political advisor. We five interviewed the finalists for a vacancy, such as the O'Connor vacancy, and then made the recommendation to the president. He would then personally interview the finalists. So the process was different depending upon the vacancy.
Mm-hmm. What were you in the interviews with the president and the candidates, or were those just the president and the
counsel? At the time, it was Harriet Myers, we didn't have a vacancy during the first term. When I was White House counsel.
You know, looking at it, and every president is going to bring a different set of experience and interests to it. What do you think President Bush was trying to achieve in that interview? Because you're really looking, I mean, I understand the law and I understand, you know, kind of, well, we want to do this, we want to do that. But yet you're really looking at the character of the person and they're going to be there for 30 years.
You're absolutely right. And President Bush was a little bit different than, say, President Obama.
Right.
Bush was not a lawyer.
Right.
So he and I, when I was White House counsel, we would have numerous conversations about judging.
Right.
And he would ask me names about, what about Mike Lutie on the Fourth Circuit or Emilio Garza on the Fifth Circuit? He would ask, because he would hear names.
Right.
And so we would talk about them, and we would talk about issues. How big a fight do you want over someone who has said something publicly on Roe v. Wade, for example?
Yeah.
We would have these kind of conversations. And so it did make a big difference. In the end, President Bush expected this little committee of five to recommend someone to him that was qualified to do the job by virtue of experience and education. He would then make an assessment of the individual as to whether or not, is this someone that I just feel comfortable with? And the reason he chose John Roberts to be the Chief Justice in the end is because he felt John Roberts had the personality to bring together four other votes on the court. And he felt that John had the right personality to be the leader, to be the Chief Justice of the court. And so I think if you were to ask President Bush, he would say he's very much a person making decisions sometimes based on his gut, how he feels. And it's for that reason that I often tried to get to know someone pretty well that was being considered for an appointment, because I knew he would ask me, what do you think about this person? So, obviously, because he wasn't a lawyer, he would depend on us to tell him whether or not we felt someone was qualified to do the job.
How did you work with the advising consent of the Senate function? It's obviously gotten to the point now where the usual, and whether one agrees with them or not, the blue slips and the filibusters. How did you all kind of approach the Senate process? Particularly if you weren't in the majority.
Right. With respect to district court judges, you really are at the mercy of the home state senators. And people don't appreciate that.
Yeah.
If they do not like who you're going to nominate and they return a negative blue slip, which is an old tradition within the Senate, your person's not even going to get a hearing in the Judiciary Committee, much less a floor vote.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it was really a challenge. And I spent a lot of my time when I was White House counsel going up to the Hill, sitting down with home state senators, and ask them, please support this nominee.
On both sides of the aisle?
On both sides.
Yeah,
no
right.
question.
No.
And on states like New York, where you had two Democratic senators, Clinton and Schumer, we had to make a deal where we would say, okay, the deal was we get to name four people for four vacancies, and then for the fifth vacancy, they would present a name. And so long as that person was, quote, qualified, then the president would go ahead and nominate that person.
Yeah.
You'd have to work out those kind of deals in home states where you had two Democratic senators. So it was a challenge.
Yeah.
And one of the big responsibilities of the White House counsel is to try to move that along and try to get the president's nominees confirmed.
Yeah. But you were always focused on, is this person really high quality, respected by peers?
I mean, that is
because your legacy really is when you talk to the lawyers, and it's like whether the judge agrees with me or not, she's a good judge. I mean,
that is the hope, and that is the goal. But I'd be less than honest if I didn't say that, we because of home state senators' preferences, sometimes we got a judge that we might not have otherwise nominated. But hopefully that they grow into the job and do a good job.
Yeah. So you're someone who grew up in Texas, made an impact practicing law in Texas, and served the governor, goes to Washington, D.C., and is now back in Nashville. Where do you tell kids the action is? How do you advise young, potential lawyers about where is the action?
I don't tell young up and coming lawyers that the action is in Washington because Washington's not for everyone, quite frankly. I think that the action can be anywhere. That a problem exists in our country, and Lord knows we have plenty of those kinds of problems, but. What I tell people who want to go to law school is lawyers are a force for good.
Yeah.
And given the nature of our society, how litigious we are, there will always be a place for a good lawyer. And the question is, do you have the capability to be a good lawyer? If you are, there's going to be a place for you.
Yeah, I think that's very, very, very well said. After you left Washington, you went to Texas Tech University, and you helped develop a leadership program to really build a more diverse pipeline for the future. And, you know, certainly as I kind of, at this point in my career, I tell people, say, what's a leader? I said, a leader just grows other leaders. I mean, we're just, it's not about us. So how did you come to selecting that particular responsibility? And then how do we really, in a really pluralistic society, develop an appreciation for the diversity of our country and serving in society?
That is a very excellent question, quite frankly. Given the growing population within certain ethnic groups, say the Hispanic population, that population is going to be much more influential in the future going forward. I think it's vital, both politically and just simply as a country, that we have leaders within that community, which isn't to say that, you know, white individuals or black individuals cannot adequately represent the interests of Hispanics. But I think it's important to the validity of the governance system of our country that everyone can look to see that all opportunities are available, no matter your skin color. And I just felt it important, given all the opportunities that I had been given, to try to help groom the next generation of leaders. That's one of the things I like to talk about at Belmont, is that we're in the business of preparing the next generation of leaders. All of us are here at Vanderbilt. It's a critical mission. And so it's something that I just, obviously, this is a great country. I love America, and it's given me so much. And I just want to make sure it remains strong. And I do not believe we as a country can remain strong unless we promote others, everyone, no matter their skin color, no matter their last name, no matter their address. So it's just something that I think is important. And I'm delighted with the success we had at Texas Tech. I'm delighted with what I see going on in Nashville, quite frankly. This is a wonderful city. Got some great leadership, and I've been very, very pleased to be a part of it.
Yeah, you've seen a fairly dramatic change in our own city, as I have, and it really it shows that the changes of the composition and leads to a really vibrant, exciting place that everyone wants to be.
Absolutely, and no, this is the it city, right?
Yeah, it's city, because there's so many different faiths and religions that come here and then join in a city with a common project.
I think the city and the state's been blessed by the state leadership has in terms of, and the governor's office and our two senators, people I think of great integrity and people willing to listen, to accommodate, to compromise. Compromise has become a dirty word in Washington, as I see it. But I think we've been very, very blessed here in Tennessee.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, I have a lot of people will say to me, "Boy, you're so lucky. You have such great leaders." And you know, I kind of brag about them around the country. We have been really, really fortunate in our state to have the kind of statewide and then local leadership that stewards our state, and I think, you know, that's what really is going to move Nashville and Tennessee and our country forward. You know, it's interesting. I think lawyers certainly have at times well-deserved criticisms directed at being argumentative and litigious and fighting over everything. But yet, the one thing that we do, and we do in the classroom, you have to in the courtroom, is the other side of the question. That you've got to entertain the sense that someone may not see the world like you.
You may be wrong.
You may be wrong, and you may have missed something. And I think that that's something that's missing in our society. And how do you try to cultivate it in the classrooms, in your discussions, in the work that you do? Because I know there are people that are always going to disagree. The question is, can you engage in a civil, respectful way and then say, okay, we agree to disagree. Now we're going to move forward and find a place to agree.
Yeah, I think you begin by talking about it. You begin by informing certainly law students at Vanderbilt, at Belmont, from the beginning, that you have an obligation to represent your client zealously. But keep your ears open. Don't always be talking, because by listening, you may learn that, well, perhaps the other side has a good argument. If you can acknowledge that, that sometimes can be to the benefit of your client, and that's a good thing. So I think you're absolutely right. I think having that kind of strategy of approaching problems, I think, can make one a very successful lawyer going forward. And quite frankly, I think will do a great service to the reputation of the legal profession. You're right. We lawyers, in the minds of some, have not so great views, opinions about the legal profession. But at the end of the day, I always remind people, when anyone gets in trouble, who do they call?
Yeah.
They call a lawyer.
Yeah. No, I also just remember, as a young lawyer, you're in a courtroom and someone is really giving you a hard time. And it's like, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think I grew up realizing that, you know, someone is going to vote against me. And they're pretty smart. And, you know, I certainly would like to believe in my case. But I remember, you know, just losing cases and saying, you know what? Yeah, I mean, I wasn't right. I think that's just that state of mind is something we have to cultivate, whether they're studying law, business, education, philosophy, you know, chemistry. I could be wrong. I mean, this.
And it's a lifelong lesson. Yeah. Imagine, I mean, I've had to walk into the Oval Office and tell the President of the United States, Mr. President, the advice that the lawyers collectively within the executive branch have given you regarding this war on terrorism issue, the Supreme Court of the United States says we're wrong.
Yeah.
So that's a tough place to be.
Yeah. Well, I think, though, that I'm sure what you brought and I think was part of your job was to respect the institutions.
No
of
question.
Government that
separation,
you know,
powers
separation
is
of powers
is to our system of government.
Yeah,
no
to our system. You know, I come to work every day, and you come to work, and I'm an optimist. You're an optimist. What keeps you so buoyant about today and the future? And
you know
what is it, Al?
When I was a boy, I learned from my dad. We would encounter something that I thought would be difficult or impossible to work around or deal with. And I would ask him, Dad, is this going to work out? And my dad would always say, it's got to work out.
Yeah.
And from that, that's sort of the attitude I have today. When I look at problems and issues, I think to myself, it's got to work out.
Yeah.
I fundamentally believe that. You know, as I said earlier, we live in the greatest country on the face of the earth, with all due respect to other countries. But, you know, like you, we've seen a lot around the world, and we just have so much to be thankful for. And I guess given my experiences and all the great things that have happened to me in this country and where I started, yeah, I feel an obligation to be optimistic, quite frankly.
I would join you on that. And, you know, you're in settings with a lot of important people, including a lot of your students and faculty and staff. And these are optimist jobs. You don't walk across a college campus and see a professor who's, you know, making Hamlet the most exciting. I mean, opening up a youngster's eyes to the richness of the bard, and that student saying, well, you know, I love Shakespeare. Maybe I'll go get a graduate degree in Elizabethan literature. Now, they might end up getting a JD or an MBA, but I think our jobs are the ultimate optimist jobs, and they're the ultimate jobs in seeing people from different paths come forward to work together. And, you know, we certainly have our challenges on our campuses, but I do think that if people came and sat at our desk and walked around our campuses, they would say, wow, we've got a lot to look forward to. And I think certainly your life and your life's work and passion is a reason for people to say, yeah, there's great things can happen. Great things can happen. So, Alberto, thank you for taking the time to join me for this discussion today. It's always an honor to have you on campus. You can download this and other episodes of the Zeppos Report at vu.edu/Zeppos-report. That's vu.edu/Zeppos-report. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.